The Court, please. The variance in this case is definitely fatal. The defendant in the indictment is charged with doing certain things from 1997 to all the way through 2002, not just in 2002. The indictment says that he entered into an agreement with Utick and Tahaje to do these various things, and it sets out various overt acts. It doesn't say he did the overt acts, but it says that from 1997 to 2002 that he was a part of the conspiracy in doing those overt acts.
Well, let's assume that you're correct, that there is a variance. Going through the record, what prejudice was caused by this? The whole purpose of the indictment is to give him notice, and he's only prejudiced if substantial rights were involved. He was adequately able to prepare a defense. He had his trial. It didn't expose him to evidentiary spillover. I mean, I can't see any prejudice in this case.
There was evidentiary spillover, Your Honor, because Utick was involved in the overt acts from 1997 to 2002. The jury was obviously confused by the fact that there was things going on from 1997 to 2002. That was made manifest when they came in with their question about whether, and I had argued to the jury that there was that the government had charged an overall conspiracy, and that they hadn't proven the overall conspiracy, although they had tried to, because they showed things that had happened in 1998, I believe. And then they came in and they had a question about that.
Had the conspiracy ended when there was only one person?
Exactly. And, of course, our position is that we should have gotten judgment of acquittal on the overall conspiracy, because the government didn't plead discrete conspiracies. The pleading is not even multiplicitous. It alleges only one overall conspiracy, and that was our defense. And the jury.
Was that basically your Rule 29?
Yes.
It would be the same as your Rule 29. That's the same argument.
Well, yes, because we're, you know, this is a federal case. Yeah, it's the same. I am bringing up that point right now because I believe that the Rule 29. I don't think it's very debatable that under Rule 29 the overall conspiracy was not proven. I'm simply saying that the variance that occurred was fatal because the government clearly alleged and argued an overall conspiracy. The government was blowing hot and cold. You know, sometimes they say that we say that it only that the indictment alleged two it was multiplicitous, and it alleged two discrete conspiracies, and then it sometimes agrees that we are only arguing that there was one overall conspiracy, and that the government had to prove that, and having failed to prove that we should get a judgment of acquittal. But I think we agree now that there's just an overall conspiracy. Assuming that I'm right about that, taking a leap of faith, then under Pinkerton, I believe that if this court agrees that a reasonable jury could not have found Nannetti guilty beyond a reasonable doubt under the evidence, then under Pinkerton, I submit that we would have to be given at the same time a new trial on the substantive offenses, because we cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt that the evidence was so overwhelming that it supported the verdict on the substance of offenses, because the evidence was that Nannetti only ran errands. He never looked for anything. He never asked for anything for running these errands. He was just carrying out what his supervisors told him to do. And the only thing he got out of this was a couple of these counterfeit bags. And the evidence was that the special agent told the person who had become the informant, Mrs. Park, Oh, phone Tahanji back again because, you know, Nanette is not getting anything out of this. We want him to get something out of it. And so she phones him back and says, well, don't you want something for Mr. Nanette too? And he says, oh, yeah, okay, I think he'd like a couple of bags. Okay, we'll give him a couple of bags. So he wanted nothing out of it. So the evidence is basically weak enough, so I don't think that this court can say beyond a reasonable doubt.
Were there a few free meals too?
Well, the free meals kind of went like this. Tahanji goes to visit, and they go to visit her at her restaurant. And he has, and keep in mind that Yutik and Tahanji are both Mr. Nanette's superiors. So come along. So he comes along, and they sit there, and they're fed, and they end up not paying for it. But it wasn't like there was any quid pro quo involved or anything of the sort. And so. Because of that, I'm not asking for a judgment of acquittal on that, but of course, but I'm saying that the jury came in, they asked their question about whether or not there could still be an overall conspiracy in effect, and right after that, after they didn't get the instruction that I think that they needed, they came in and found the defendant guilty on not just the conspiracy.
He was there at trial, Mr.?
Yes.
So, why don't you reconstruct the scene for us? The jury comes back because it's smelled. And what happened at that point?
Okay, the jury comes back with its smell.
Did you offer up a supplemental instruction?
I didn't offer up a supplemental instruction in so many words, and I did say that the answer, the correct answer.
Why don't you tell me what you did in so many words?
Yes.
The jury asked,
when a conspiracy is reduced to one number, does that conspiracy end and another one begin? Well, of course, the situation was I thought I had something cooking here. Okay, so I said to the judge, I have to admit.
It sounded like the jury was at least considering the possibility that the conspiracy was down to one person.
Right, and so maybe they very well may have been considering this as an overall conspiracy, and maybe they were thinking of acquitting because I had very carefully, although I didn't get a specific instruction on that, I had argued just precisely that as a matter of fact to them.
So you had them going.
I had them going. Right, and so I said to the judge, well, of course the answer to that is yes. I didn't precisely say to him, just say to them yes, and of course this is in the heat of battle.
I'm not trying to label. I'm just trying to understand what.
Yes.
What the district judge was.
And so the judge said, oh, no, because, you know, that's not going to be fair to the government because I'm going to be giving them enough instructions, so. If I may interpolate, you know, so they'll really understand what's going on, so they mean that the government just might win the case, if I may, all right. And so the judge said, I'm just going to read back the instructions that I originally gave. And, of course, what he's doing is reading back the instructions that created the problem in the first place. They'd already been told that an informant, for example, or when a person is an informant, that they cannot be a part of a conspiracy. And I had pointed that out to them in the closing argument. So they went back in, and so I thought, well, maybe something good is going to come of this. I don't know if I'd left the building or I just went back to the office. For example, we had a...
If you had to do it over again, what... what would you suggest the district court have done in this situation? It's a very tricky situation because they ask a compound question. You know, one conspiracy ends, another conspiracy begins. It's a very sort of tricky, difficult question.
Yes.
And it's difficult for the district judge to answer the question without seeming to push him into one direction or another. And I realize, you know, there you are in the middle of trial and the next day, everybody thinks of the things they should have done in court the day before. So let's just look at this. I mean, what should the district judge under ideal conditions, and if you'd had time to reflect on it, if you'd had time to reflect on it, and offer, how should he have answered this difficult, complex question without coming down on one side or the other without seeming to push the jury in one direction.
Well, I suppose, and now I have the benefit of a number of cases that have said this, he shouldn't have just said, well, yes, you know, and sent them back again, I suppose. But they asked when the conspiracy is reduced to one...
But it's hard to answer that yes without also seeming to suggest there were two conspiracies. That one stopped and the other one started. So, you know, the question wasn't
without directing a verdict, so to speak.
Yeah, it wasn't just a question of, you know, what happens. Has the conspiracy stopped when it's down to one person? That you can easily answer yes, but they asked a compound question.
Right.
One stops, the other one starts up. Right. And a yes answer to that says quite a bit more than.
Right. But here's what I think the judge should have done. He should have said, well. When a conspiracy is reduced to one member, I think he could have specifically told them, he's not saying yes, that the conspiracy would end, of course, because that's the law. I don't think he should have said, and another one begins, because now we're talking about telling them that there, you know, there was an additional conspiracy. I don't think that's beneficial to either side particularly. But I think that they had to be instructed in some way to understand that they must have been, I think we can assume that they might very well have been thinking, we've got the indictment, we know this started in, they're supposed to have started in 97, it ends in 2002, it is pled as if there is an overall conspiracy, there's nothing about Mrs. Park becoming an informant in the middle of the indictment, and so they have to understand. They may have already understood that you can't enter into a conspiracy with an informant. But, of course, at the beginning, Mrs. Park was not an informant. And so they were already told that you can't have a conspiracy with an informant. Now, I argued exactly, you know, what I wanted them to find. And I argued, you know, that the conspiracy had been reduced to one number and therefore it ended. And if there was another one, it began up again. But the judge doesn't tell them to ignore what I say, but the judge, on the other hand, says, well, you know, that what the counsel says is just arguments and really directed maybe more to the factual situation, but they had heard what I had to say. They were agreeing with me, and what they were doing, I think, is checking with the judge to see, well, is Mr. Trapp giving it to us straight? Is he telling us the truth about this? And they wanted to know that. And the judge didn't say anything that would indicate that what I had said was correct. He simply sent them back to the drawing board. Well, they not only had heard those instructions, but they had them in writing. So they had gone over them. We have to assume that they had gone over them to some extent before they asked the question, and they couldn't figure it out.
But you understand the reluctance of a judge that has a jury in the courtroom to avoid seeming to endorse the position of one lawyer or another. And I realize that it might have been perfectly okay for the judge to do that if he had chosen to do it, but I have some difficulty finding an abuse of discretion.
Which is the test.
Which is the test. When the judge chooses not to do that, for reasons I understand perfectly well, and I'm sure my colleagues do, and in your heart you probably do as well, that the judge does not want to be up here. Because, you of course, you never know what happens when you come down on one side or the other. Sometimes the jury reacts the other way. Says, you know, so all sorts of things can happen with a jury, sort of sensitive animal there. So he says, look, we've got instructions that if you pause carefully, we'll give you the answer. And the judge might have thought, I think might reasonably have thought, the reason they don't know the answer to this question is they haven't focused, you know, there are a lot of instructions there, they don't know which ones to focus on, so I'll tell them, read particularly carefully these three instructions, and if you read the three instructions together, you know, with this question in mind, if you just take these three instructions from the group you're given, you know, you will deduce the answer. I have a hard time coming up with abuse of discretion there. You know, I might have done differently, I might not have done differently in the circumstances.
Well, you know, the unfairness arises against the background of the jury seeming to be coming around to my argument. The jury must have focused on those instructions because I used the instructions, and you can see in the transcript, I used the instructions. That's why we like, of course, to have an agreement on instructions before we argue. I use the instructions to argue to the jury, because if I say the judge is going to tell you something and then the judge tells them something, it gives me a certain credibility. So we had been over that.
In a sense, then, the judge did sort of endorse your argument. You know, if you harp on these instructions and he comes back and he says, look at these instructions, he sort of endorsed your argument without doing so.
Suggest it's an abuse of discretion because, I mean, is it should be held against the defendant that he's making some progress in the case? Should it be held against the defendant that the jury is coming around to his way of thinking? I think that the jury made it clear that they were confused. And the only way you could straighten them out is to say that not only is it the case that when a person is supposedly involved with a conspiracy, but they're an informant, they're not a conspirator, but that when if they become an informant and it's reduced to one number, that there is no conspiracy to solve the problem for them, because we're supposed to be doing fact.
It's a tough road to hoe, yeah. But I think you've done as well with it as could be done. You would have saved the.
I think I'll save the balance. I'll pass on arguing as to the sentencing aspects.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll next hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. Karen Johnson for the United States.
How are you? You think you can pull that mic down just a little bit and point it toward?
Is this good?
You know, us short people have to sort of do that our entire lives.
Actually, we're all short. So.
That's right.
I've been looking at the step under here. I was debating if I should get up on it, but if this is all right.
The kitty step, I've been there.
But may it please the Court, I don't agree with counsel's initial analysis, perhaps due to a cynicism on the corruption of the Guam Customs Authority. There was one conspiracy here, and I believe that Mr. Nettie was part of the network that UDIC had, starting in 1997.
So is it your position, did the jury find him guilty of a single or continuing conspiracy?
I think they found him guilty of a single conspiracy that spanned that period of time for two reasons. We know that he was corrupt, as was Mr. Tahaji, when they shook down Mrs. Park in 1998. You may recall in the brief, she brought in a container load of restaurant equipment, which got inspected one day by regular customs authorities. And here comes the defendant and his supervisor, Tahaji, the next day to do another inspection. She says, but I've already been inspected. Oh, we're going to do it again, they say.
But also in 1998, UDIC tells Park he can't help anymore.
He got scared
after that.
Well, I think that Nanetti and Udig and Tahaji, with a network of individuals, so that one customs officer can't do this alone. At the air cargo terminal, you have to have your supervisor at least on board. It helps if you have other members of the shift on board. The fact that when Mrs. Park went to him in 2002 and said, I want to bring in more goods, can you help me? He didn't miss a beat. He didn't say, let me look around and see who I can find to help us. He pulled out a piece of paper and wrote the defendant's name and phone number on it. And well, said,
sure.
This man will help you.
I concede, at least as I read the record, they're all part of a group. They all know what they're doing. But what did he do between 1998 and 2002?
He did the same as Mr. Udick, and that is nothing. In 1997, I believe that they were all involved. After February or March of 1998, they got scared and they stopped for a while.
So you say they're still all involved together, but
I think they were still all involved together.
They just retreated until they found a better.
They got scared and they suspended their operation. They did not cease them.
You can say the suspended. I mean, these are sort of conclusions. I mean, what do they have? Sort of meetings where they meet together and say, well, let's stay put for a while longer. I mean, it sounds to me like they were doing this activity for whatever reason. They got scared or no opportunities or, you know, who knows. They cease doing them for a long time. We're not talking about 2 months or 6 months. We're talking about 4 years, right?
Yes, almost 4 years.
There's no evidence the government has put in the record that there was any communication during this time, any minutes of meetings of the conspiracy, or anything. There was discussed, that there was any attempts or anything else.
Yes.
It's a complete absence of activity. Now, I was speculating that they sort of... I think what you said is, you know, every so often they must have met and said, you know, should we start up again? And they said, no, not yet. It's too hard. I mean, that's what I was speculating, but there's no evidence of that.
There's an absence of activity concerning Mrs. Park. And what the others were doing,
Was there any evidence in the record of any activity whatsoever with respect to anybody?
No.
Okay, so we don't know. I mean, we can speculate. We can guess that there was... That they give each other furtive glances, or maybe had discussions that said, you know, do you think the coast is clear yet? And no, you know, I mean, but we don't know. For all we know, the they call an end to it, and then an opportunity arises for whatever reason 4 years later.
Well, you have another piece of evidence.
Well, maybe it would be easiest. What evidence in the record supports a finding that there's a continuing conspiracy?
Starting in 1997?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously there's an attack on the sufficiency of the evidence. So what is the evidence in the record and the inferences that go with it?
Okay.
That you're
concerning beginning in 1997, the fact that, were two things, that Mr. Udig knew that this man would help him, implying that he had been helping him. And second, that when Mrs. Park...
Mr. Minetti.
Yeah.
Man means defendant.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just want to make sure I have the cast.
That Udig knew that the defendant would help him, as evidenced by the fact he pulls out her name and phone number. I mean, nothing about letting him make a phone call first. The second piece of evidence is the meeting at Daiichi restaurant. When Mrs. Park says, you know, I was bringing in goods with Mr. Udig, paying him between $300 and $500 a shipment, and no one misses a beat. When she talked about bringing in more purses, no one ever says, what do you mean? They say, oh, yeah, don't bring it in on Sunday because I don't work Sundays. It showed a knowledge of the overall scheme and a willingness to participate, which I think the jury could have found that they had been previous participants in this overall network of customs officers. Certainly, the defendant was aware that Mrs. Park had been doing this with Udig because she laid it out for them at lunch. $300 to $500 a shipment, I'm willing to do the same thing for you. And these guys said, sign us up. We'll do it for you. So if they were not involved in the initial conspiracy, they certainly joined it when they were fully advised of the scope of it and they said, sign us up. And third, of course, if the court finds that there was a break, then there certainly was a variance, but not a prejudicial one. The jury convicted him of the substantive offenses of bribery and trafficking.
Well, I don't understand how it can be non-prejudicial. If there were, in fact, two conspiracies rather than one, then you've got a variance. You haven't got they've been convicted of a crime that wasn't charged. How could that possibly be non-prejudicial?
Well, under United States versus Berger, it sets out the criteria. The fundamental issue is the defendant on notice as to what the charge is so he can defend against it. Obviously, he was here. Is there a question of double...
I mean, he's on notice to defend against one conspiracy. The way you defend against one conspiracy is by showing that there was a gap. There were two conspiracies, in fact, and there was a time in between there where there was no... the only other participant was a government informant, and that broke the chain. That's how he presents his defense.
Yes.
The government said, look, he was involved in two conspiracies separated by a gap, presumably he would have presented a different defense or pled guilty, whatever.
As I understand deciding whether a variance is prejudicial under U.S. versus Berger, you look at fundamentally, did the jury unanimously find a set of facts that supports the conviction? There was no dispute that in 2002 the defendant recruited his supervisor. Because Udig went to the defendant went to his supervisor and signed him up. Whether the defendant committed a set of facts upon which they could find that he conspired with Udig and Tahaji to commit these offenses. And there's no, in fact, they did not dispute that, in fact, that is exactly what he did. That was, there was no dispute.
Well, let me ask you this. If it turns out, if you sort of magically knew what happened in the jury room, and it turns out that the jury said, yeah, you know, one of them convicted because there was a conspiracy, and then it stopped, and then he started a second conspiracy, and he was on board, the defendant was on board in both of these conspiracies, and the way we understand the indictment and jury instructions, that's good enough to convict, and they all agree on that.
It is good enough to convict.
Well, how could that possibly be when the government charges one conspiracy and indictment, and the defendant tries hard to disprove that notion, and the jury then comes back and says, oh, well, two conspiracies are just as good as one.
Well, that is the rule.
I mean, how can that be good enough?
Because they would have under the facts of this case, they would have unanimously found that he joined with these other two people in 2002 to conspire to commit the two crimes charged. By the facts of this case, they had to have done that because they convicted him of the substantive offenses. And that's the fundamental issue.
So you would just look at the sort of second, what we sort of term the second conspiracy, and so long as you follow that, that's good enough.
That would unquestionably be good enough to support these convictions.
And the gap in before that doesn't.
I don't.
Okay.
Yeah. That's our position.
Okay.
And concerning Pinkerton,
concerning
Pinkerton, I think the law is pretty clear on this, that if you have an aiding and abetting instruction also, that you may find that the defendant unanimously, you have evidence from which they could unanimously support a conviction on aiding and abetting. And we know that they thought that also because, again, they convicted him of the substantive offenses, which were aiding and abetting offenses.
Let me ask you about the bribery offense. He went to lunch a couple of times and got a couple of handbags.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really enough to convict him of bribery?
Oh, yes. It's anything of value, Your Honor, and these things are of value. The purses, as counterfeits, and that's not the real thing, but as counterfeits was selling her store between $100 and $400. That's what tourists are paying for these counterfeits.
Right. He didn't ask for those, did he?
He accepted them.
He accepted them, but he didn't ask for them. And then,
no, his confederate, Mr. Tahaji, asked for them.
Yes, and Mr. Tahaji said, you know, let them give us lunch. He didn't come in and say, I will do this if you will give me lunch.
No, they were doing things for her, and they were getting things in return. And that is bribery. They were getting something of value. And there was plenty of evidence in the record to support that.
Were you counsel at trial?
Yes, I was.
Also, well, I just a question in terms of did, since we have both counsel from trial here, was it argued that the arguments that Judge Nelson is making right now, were those arguments that were argued to the jury and then the jury was given the law on what bribery is and then the jury resolved those factual issues? Or
my recollection is that the amount of the bribe, I don't think, was an issue. The fact that there was a bribe, counsel maybe could remember his closing argument better than I do. My recollection is that
you mean it wasn't memorable?
No, it's always memorable, but not that memorable. I don't think that the fact that it was a small amount of money or a small amount of value was an issue because the statute provides anything of value. But we have here.
But I wonder though, who has the burden of? I think if I understand the import of just Callahan's question is whether or not this issue was preserved for appeal. The sufficient, you know, whether it was a. I mean, let's say it was a completely trivial amount. The government has the burden to present some material bribe, you know, something that's more
something of value.
Something of value.
Yeah.
If it's something that's empty paper cup with water in it, it wouldn't be a bribe,
sure,
even though it were established.
Sure.
And that would be the government's burden, and there would be no issue that that's preserved for appeal if there was a failure of proof on that.
Well, that was not the basis of counsel's Rule 29 motion. And that is the first, in fact, that I've heard
but
of.
But let's say it's not raised by a Rule 29 motion at all.
Then I do not think it's before this court.
Sufficiency is always an issue, isn't it? If the government must prove a bribe and the evidence it submits shows that the evidence of bribe is entirely trivial, consists of nothing of value. That's an issue that's obviously...
It's a case of notice. In other words, when we prepare our briefs, we prepare them on the objections that have been raised below and the issues that have been preserved for appeal.
But this was in the brief here.
Well, only because I set out the generally pertinent facts. But counsel in his brief did not question value. And if the court, for example, wondered if there was sufficiency of the evidence on value, I would have written my brief differently. And that would have been a topic I would have addressed in my brief. I did not, because that issue, as far as I understand, is not before this court. They have conceded that issue. The defendants went in for lunch. They liked the most expensive thing on the menu, a $30 a bowl seafood soup. Oh, yes.
Must have made some bowl.
Yes. And it's simply not an issue before this court, as I understand it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Trapp, you've got just shy of 4 minutes for a moment.
It is true that we have not raised... we did move under Rule 29 for a judgment of acquittal as to all four counts. I did not raise on this appeal, although I suppose the court could use plain error analysis if they wished to. I mentioned it passing, but the point is, it was argued. I argued that in the first place the bags were junk, and so how could anybody think that they were counterfeit? And so they weren't, because there's a defense built into that. I won't go into it. And I argued that he hardly got anything, that they had to sort of force it on him. And so that goes to the issue as to whether or not the court can say beyond a reasonable doubt that if I'm right about the conspiracy count, that the jury did not convict him of the substantive accounts, as they cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt that they did not convict him because of Pinkerton, because there's no question that Udig was getting something, no question that Tahaji was getting something. And so if under Pinkerton, then he could be convicted, because there's no question but what Tahaji really received bribes. On the beyond a reasonable doubt, the question also was, keep in mind that on sentencing, Judge Pinkel was no longer on the bench. Judge Pragerson, District Court Judge Pragerson, gave him a minor role adjustment because he was so little involved in this. We submit.
Thank you very much. Cases have been sent to me. We thank counsel for very helpful arguments. We will not next hear argument in United States versus McNeil.
May it please the Court, Peter Esser representing Mr. McNeil.
Will you pull the microphone out?
Yeah.
Hard to hear. Thank you.
Is this a 10 or a 20-minute argument? There seems to have been some debate. I assume it's a 20.